Hello. Hi, guys. I think we'll get started. It's about 12:30. So I am Jenna Wortham, and I'm a tech reporter for The New York Times. As you all know, probably know, this is Jeff Jordan, general partner at Andreessen Horowitz. He has a very illustrious history behind him. Comes from many, many years working at PayPal and eBay, and now he's working at one of the hottest investment firms in Silicon Valley. So we sort of thought we would talk a little bit about kind of, you know, Jeff's journey and then some of the current trends in the startup world, the mobile industry, and kind of go from there. Oh, and what I would love to do also is I thought we'd save some time at the end for questions, but throughout the course of our conversation, if you guys feel there's something topical that you want to discuss, you know, feel free to come up. Oh, we've got a starter. What should it be? What do you want it to be? You tell me. So the hashtag is hashtag SX, eBay2VC. Okay, but I'm going to try not to check my phone too much, so if you have questions, it's easier to come up, so I'll miss it in that reply. So, okay. So, all right, so we'll begin.
Excellent.
And everyone, Jeff flew in this morning from San Francisco just to be with us today.
So,
I think that warrants an applause.
So he's bleary-eyed, just so you know. It's,
I was telling him that I got home at 4 a.m. this morning, and he said he got up at 4 a.m. this morning to come here and be with us. So, yeah. Okay, so as many of you probably know, you know, Andreessen Horowitz has this incredibly interesting investment portfolio right now. They've put money into Pinterest, Groupon, Zynga, check my list, Twitter, Fab.com. I'm missing a couple of the really
Airbnb,
good ones. Airbnb.
Yeah. Yep.
So I thought it could be really helpful and interesting to start off sort of talking about, you know, from your perspective. I mean, you guys probably see an insane amount of people coming in through your door all the time. You're probably seeing some of the newest, most interesting startups that we all want to know about. But, you know, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what catches your eye, I mean, the kinds of things that you guys are finding really compelling right now, and what's of the most interest to you?
No, that's I appreciate that. The investment premise of the firm is that about a dozen companies each year create virtually all the returns in the venture business. And this has been, you know, historically true. So our job is to try to find those dozen companies. And we're completely stage agnostic. We'll write a check from a, you know, teeny little seed check to up to $100 million growth investment. But our goal is to be in those interesting companies. So when the firm first started, you know, Facebook and Groupon and Zynga were already running, you know, well past their early stage venture. So we made growth investments in those. On the other side, we're early investors in companies like Pinterest and Airbnb and Fab. So we're trying to find those companies. And what is fascinating about the job is every day people like you come in talking about what they're trying to build, and, you know, and trying to make, you know, create, you know, an act of complete creation, make something out of nothing. And it's just inspiring to hear, you know, what everyone's doing. And it's a fun job to go to every day.
Excellent. Very cool. And so what also might be kind of neat to talk about is, you know, you were formerly the chief executive of OpenTable and then spent a lot of time at head of products or development at eBay. Yep. And before that, you were at PayPal. Yep. So how does that history kind of inform the kinds of things that you're looking at or sort of how you're thinking about, you know, how the tech world is evolving or how innovation is developing, and actually maybe even talk about kind of your journey from those companies to Andreessen Horowitz for those in the room who don't know.
Okay, that's a lot. I was, early in my career, I spent 8 years at the Walt Disney Company, and my hiring manager there was a woman named Meg Whitman. So never burn a bridge. I joined eBay in 99, and at that point I was employee 200 or 300, and I soon after started managing eBay.com, the website. So I was responsible for the marketing and product of the website. My partner, Maynard Webb, ran the technology and the customer support, and we partnered in building that business. And I mean, it was just fascinating. That was early in the internet. The business, by the metrics at the time, enjoyed explosive growth. Now would be considered pedestrian, interestingly enough, because the way things can grow these days. But I got to manage eBay for about 4 or 5 years. Was was the driver behind eBay's acquisition of PayPal, because essentially I was running an e-commerce site that didn't have a cart. We were hiding the way you paid on eBay because we had a lame competitive product. So and after 5 years at eBay, I ran PayPal for about two and a half years, took a little time off, and then OpenTable came calling. So I did that for 4 years. They all are very similar businesses at the end of the day. They're network effects businesses where the consumer's being introduced to small businesses in some form. So what I find now that I'm doing as an investor is informed by those experiences. I love e-commerce. I love marketplace businesses. Mobile's extraordinarily important to OpenTable. So looking at mobile opportunities. So I'm the consumer guy at Andreessen Horowitz. A lot of my partners, I have a much more hardcore enterprise background.
Excellent. And, okay, I didn't realize all that. That's very cool. So in terms of kind of, you guys are sort of at the, very well-reputed, very well-known firm. You guys, you were chatting about earlier. I mean, a lot of people are kind of out in the field looking for that next hot deal. You guys are kind of trying to manage the influx of people who are promising you that they're the next hot deal. I mean, what is that process like? I mean, how do you guys decide sort of how to, like what companies that you're going to meet with? I mean, how do you sort of go through that process
and
manage
the
influx?
No, it's the way Mark and Ben have positioned the firm in just 2.5 years is pretty astonishing. I mean, the firm just was founded 2.5 years ago, and I think we now have $2.7 billion of capital under management. So explosive growth, and we're incredibly gratified that entrepreneurs are interested in the potential to work for us. So the hard part is, which one do you look at? I mean, we have six GPs. We all should do about 10 board seats, so that's a capacity of 60 companies. And I think last year alone, we saw something like 1,600 referred deals. So I'll describe my first week to give you a sense of what it was. I think I saw a dozen companies present to us during the first week. I personally would have funded 10 of them. I mean, just so the quality of deals that come to you is astonishing. So the hardest thing to do is to calibrate, what is the great deal that can take up one of those incredibly scarce board seats? Because we don't do passive investing, we do active investing. So, it's fascinating. So you're looking at all these deals, and then suddenly, a Pinterest walks in the door, and it becomes incredibly clear, that's one. And but the hardest part is just the sifting through what all are really interesting, compelling ideas for those what we think are the gems out of that group.
Cool. That's actually a nice segue. I was going to bring this up towards the end of the conversation, but since you just mentioned it, and it's sort of the hot topic, it's on everyone's tongues. We've been talking about it a bunch here. You and I had talked about it today. Pinterest is this incredibly hot commodity right now, and it sort of feels almost dark horse isn't the right word, but it kind of feels like it came out of left field, and all of a sudden, they've been around since 2009. The last 6 to 8 months, it's all anyone's talking about. They've caused this kind of ripple effect, across the web in terms of other sites shifting their own design to look more like Pinterest, and then you have a bunch of, replicate or copycat sites cropping
clones.
Up.
Clones.
Clones coming up. Mantresting is the one that is the funniest to me. And so it kind of begs the question, and I'll be really reductive here, but from a very simplistic point, it's like, so what is so compelling about a site that just lets you pin images to it? And we've sort of seen this before on the web. It's not that entirely new, but they're obviously doing something right. So what is it?
I mean, first of all, Ben designed a beautiful product. Mm-hmm. He's been working on it for 2.5 years. So it's funny to hear it overnight sensation. There was an enormous amount of work to get to that, the magic that has taken off like that. Mm-hmm. Pinterest is a site about discovering real world things, be it things you're passionate about, things you want to buy, places you want to go, things you want to do. That real-world discovery in a visual format has really resonated with people. When we first announced the deal, I'm privileged to be on some really good boards. The inflow of, I'm addicted to that site, I love that site, on email was pretty astonishing. I mean, so it's really touched a chord. One of the things that's incredibly, almost unique about it is it's a really broad in scope. It is hot in Austin, but it's also hot in Dallas, in Houston, Houston and Indianapolis. It's a very much of a national phenomenon. I get my Google News feed for all my companies, and on Pinterest there'll be a dozen a day, and they're all, you know, that most are from Middle America. So it's not the edgy tech phenomenon. It is a mainstream phenomenon, and I think people just find the discovery, the visual discovery of it, and the social discovery of it enchanting.
Right, right, and I know Pinterest doesn't actually disclose this information, but in terms of growth and user numbers, but Nielsen has them at, I think it's 16.1 uniques a month, and that's up 40% from just a few months ago. And I'm trying to think other stats. I think, oh yeah, Hitwise said that they cracked, I think this was in December, they cracked the sort of top 10 lists of most traffic social networking sites, which is, you know, the realms are occupied by Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. So, you know, pretty high level adoption and popularity pretty quickly. Is that, just to put that into context, I mean, how rare is that? I mean, is that sort of, you know, typical, or is that kind of something that is pretty unique?
Businesses are growing faster now than they've ever grown in the world. I mean, we thought eBay grew fast. I'm on the board of a company, a site called Fab.com. Mm-hmm. Fab started as a social network for the gay community. And the founders worked it hard, weren't pleased with the growth, had done a little bit of e-commerce as part of that offering, and went to the board and pivoted. So in June or July of last year, they sent their first, they became an e-commerce site around great design, and they sent their first email. They were at a $50 million run rate in November. And so, you know, companies can just go from nothing to enormous these days. So Pinterest, when it started to accelerate, did accelerate pretty dramatically. But the metric that we were most taken with is their engagement metric. The only site I've seen that has engagement among its users of akin to Pinterest for me is Facebook. Its users are on it all the time. They come back frequently, and they spend an enormous amount of time on it.
Huh, that's interesting. And why do you think, I'm just really fascinated by this company right now, so I hope that's okay, but you know, why do you think that services are able to get, you know, sort of gain such traction so much faster? Is it because there's already this social layer, this sort of social architecture or infrastructure on the web that is Facebook, and that sort of things spread more quickly because of that? It's easier to sign up and tell your friends about it.
I mean, I think that, first of all, there's just more users. Yeah. But then I think Facebook really is a accelerator for discovery of the companies. I think that was true of Pinterest. I think that's true of Fab. I think that's true of Airbnb. So I do think that, you know, Pinterest actually still formally is enclosed. It's a closed site. It's in beta. You know, you can't sign up on the homepage. So it's you know, Facebook has been instrumental to its expansion. Typically, you get on Pinterest by being invited through Facebook.
Right, right. And then one more thing I wanted to touch on about Pinterest, because one of the reasons the company is so fascinating to me is as you kind of mentioned before, sort of the broad range of people that use it. And I was chatting with the Angry Birds guys, the Rovio guys yesterday, and they're on Pinterest, and they, you know, it's like, and that doesn't necessarily feel like a one-to-one fit, but they see a ton of opportunity there because they get so much fan art, there's so many Angry Birds cakes, there's so many Angry Birds costumes, it's a lot easier to sort of post a visual representation of that, as opposed to something like on another site or Facebook where it's, you kind of have to dig through, it's nice to sort of see that in an array. And what I think is so interesting about Pinterest is that we're sort of moving towards a model that is a social networking model that's not necessarily about friends, but about interests. Yep. And so I wanted to use that as a way to segue to talking about, does Pinterest kind of represent a new type of startup or tech company that we're going to see that's sort of getting beyond just the basic layer of social? And that social then just means, you know, you have a presence on the web, but what we're really looking at is building sites that kind of foster a different kind of either experience, engagement, community, really, or I said experience, but, you know, something that's not just sort of your, you know, hub for the web, which is kind of what Facebook becomes.
Right. I mean, I think most businesses other than Facebook would fall into that. I mean, Facebook really has become that
Yellow Pages the web, essentially.
It's there. But, you know, Pinterest did tap into something that its core is social. It's social discovery. You follow friends. You find people who share your interests through Pinterest, and following them and understanding what they're doing is a core part of that experience. So I think I'm not sure we see a trend other than businesses will keep growing faster than they've ever grown before once they capture the light, you know, that magic in a bottle. There are a lot of examples out there. We're privileged to work with a number of them.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned social discovery, which is a big topic this weekend. So far at South By, I mean, everyone's talking about this new category of apps. Highlight is one, Glancy is another, there's Kismet. I mean, there's dozens. Kismet, or not dozens, but at least a dozen. Kismet. I'd be curious to know of how many people this weekend have either downloaded or are starting to use one of these kinds of apps that help you kind of meet other people that you may not know that are in the immediate vicinity. Okay. And what do you guys think so far? You're into it, Ben?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I couldn't tell. It was like rock on or... It's killing your battery? It hasn't been killing my battery. Okay. Okay, that's
interesting. He has more friends. Yeah.
You have more.
Yeah.
You're more popular than I am. Yeah. Well, the reason I bring that up is because one of the companies that Andreessen Horowitz has invested in was formerly Like a Little, and now it's just called Circle.
Circle.
Or?
Yep.
Circle. And so Like a Little was a kind of a dating site, and now Circle is one of these social discovery apps. And so, I mean, what's interesting to me, it's we're sort of seeing this emergence of a new genre, class of services that are building on top of what already exists. They're sort of revealing what's this sort of layer of metadata that's already invisible and around us so that, we may not have met before, but I actually know you. We have connections in common and sort of revealing things about the world to you. And so, I think it might be interesting to sort of talk about, how that kind of evolves as a category. I mean, this is sort of the first iteration of that, and the fact that we have these devices all the time that are basically dividing rods and can pick stuff out for us, but is this just the beginning?
We think it's just the beginning. We have Evan Reese of Like a Little, now Circle, been working on this problem for a while. Facebook pretty much defines your friends. I mean, so that's the Bible. What it doesn't necessarily do a good job of is both telling them when they're in proximity, as well as telling you interesting things about you. So, Evan and the others are working on a problem that is that's trying to manufacture serendipity. There are certain things that are of interest to a lot of people when they discover they share it with someone. Hometown, university, sports teams, whatever they are. If you're away, if I'm in, in the Barcelona airport and find out there's someone from my hometown of Portola Valley there, that is interesting to me. And these apps are trying to manufacture those connections. You have a friend in Barcelona. There's a couple people near you who share interests that you might find interesting if you want. And it's trying to manufacture that serendipity. So we think we definitely think it's a trend, and it's enabled by location, which wasn't the smartphone location device, which wasn't really available when Facebook started. So it's a different use case.
It's a different use case. And does it? I mean, do we get? Because right now it's sort of. I think we're still trying to figure out how to negotiate the fact that we do have these devices with us all the time. They do take up so much of our attention. We're already so consumed with what we're doing on them all the time. I mean, do we get to the point where, instead of sort of talking to people because we're doing this anyway, that this just then becomes that bridge between meeting new people? Or
it's an interesting question. I've got 17-year-old twins, and I was joking yesterday. My daughter was hanging with a bunch of friends, and all four of them were staring at their hands. It was on the device. You're kind of like, why do you get together? Is the signal faster if you stand next to each other?
Amplifies.
But I think part of it is it's just getting so useful. There's so many things you can do using it and leveraging it that it's there. And I think part of it's unhealthy. We're always connected, and when I take my phone, pardon me, to the bathroom with me, that's a real problem. I mean, that's put it down. You'll be okay. I find I'm using my mobile device now when I'm sitting at my computer. And so the utility is a different utility. Location is a strong part of that utility, but the form factor is just better. I mean, for me, the computer is a hardcore email device at this point. I mean, that's about it. It's an authoring tool.
Interesting. Well, I guess what I was really trying to ask or really trying to get at is we were just sort of talking about, Pinterest's appeal and its success and popularity is really based on the fact that, it didn't really grow out of this sort of typical tech, epicenters of San Francisco and New York and then kind of migrate middle. It sort of started in the middle and migrated out to the coast and down, which is what makes it so unique. And I think the question that always comes up when we talk about, new mobile services or especially new services that deal, mobile services that deal with location, and then to add on top of that, location that's taking advantage of the fact that you're if you're always on and aware. I mean, it's the kind of thing I wonder for us. We're all pretty savvy. We sort of understand how these work and what we're sort of opting into when we download them. So it's not a problem for us to play around with it. It's something like this and sort of give it a stress test and see how it works. But is there a sense that at some point everyone, you know, not just sort of the tech set or people that are typical early adopters will be using these kinds of services, or did they sort of just end up being kind of, you know, the tools of the digital natives?
Is this the social discovery services specifically?
Specifically, okay, yeah. Social discovery.
You know, that's the big TBD. I mean, there's no question that people in this room will try it out. I mean, there's been a lot of PR and event management to engineer that for you. So, the real question is, does it go beyond that? I mean, so Twitter went beyond that, clearly. Mm-hmm. This is, do people at large find utility in being told that someone interesting is near them, or they're their friends near them? I mean, that's a TBD. We're betting it will, with our Circle investment, but it's we get to see.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. So actually, while we're on the topic of talking about Circle and how Circle transitioned into being like a little, we chatted about this the other day, but sort of the art of the successful pivot. And one of the things that I'm always glad not to be, an entrepreneur or a CEO, because I would have no idea. I mean, how do you decide when to sort of, fold or stick with your cards and sort of see, remain convinced that this is going to pay off, or when do you just sort of decide, you've got to toss in the towel? I mean, did you sort of help them at all, navigate that shift? Or?
I think it's a really tough thing to do, because as an entrepreneur, you have to believe maniacally in what you're doing. And at some point, to pivot, you have to say it's not working well enough. Mm-hmm. We worked with Evan through that. Evan, there were elements that Evan learned a lot from, like a little. It had explosive early growth, and he wanted to work on the engagement metrics against it. So he pivoted. I mean, pivots are fascinating to watch. The Fab one is one of my favorite, from a social network to the gay community to retail, basically overnight. He called the board and said, by the way, I'm changing the plan. PayPal pivoted about five different times. PayPal started as a way to beam money between Palm Pilots. At one point, they were a digital currency. They wanted to be a bank. They just were pivoting around. One day, an engineer enabled the capability, instead of docking your Palm Pilots. By the way, who here has seen a Palm Pilot? Hey,
yes.
We got some. All right.
Nice.
And they have a museum around here? Is that but instead of needing to dock your Palm Pilot to change currency, an engineer said, how about if we just let them type it in on the internet? And they started to get adopted immediately. And they called the user saying, why are you using it? And it turned out they were all eBay sellers. And they stumbled into eBay's, been on their fifth pivot. So watching an entrepreneur, make that change, to have the courage and fighting through their own beliefs, saying this isn't good enough, I can do better,
right,
is just a fascinating process. And a lot go through it. It's more the rule than the exception.
More the rule. Yeah, it seems like the kind of thing that's more of an art than a science, because you really have to sort of try and figure out if your idea isn't catching on because it's ahead of its time, or it's not the right time,
it's core to building a company that you believe. I mean, you have to believe so much that you convince the others around you, your employees, your investors, your everything else. So to suspend that belief for a while and take a pivot, I think, is hard. A really interesting book was written on this. A guy named Randy Commissar over at Kleiner wrote a book called Plan B. And it talks about, it's a very fact-based way to assess whether you need to pivot. And I found it a very interesting read.
That's interesting. I mean, one of the things I wanted to touch on this panel too a little bit were sort of to try to toss out any kind of, things that you've gleaned from your experiences that might be helpful. I don't know if there are some entrepreneurs in the room that are thinking about whether or not to, shift what they're doing or try something new because their kind of first idea isn't catching on. I mean, do you have any sort of advice or thoughts on how to make that call?
I've been in the side chair. I've never been in the chair. I was an operator. I joined eBay at 200 people and, ran that to, I think it was 13,000 when I left. OpenTable, I joined at a couple hundred people. So I've come in early, but I've never done, everything I've joined has been working. So I've been next to it. I mean, I think the key thing is set objectives objective criteria for where you want to be, because you can you know, just keep extending your horizon out of that belief you have to have. And if if the core objectives you're just not getting there, that should be job one. Job two is get people associated with the business who are willing to tell you that love you, this one ain't working. We have to figure it out. And then stay maniacally close to your customers and understand what they like and what they don't like, and look for those signals if I switch this a little bit, it could work. But complete customer centric approach can help you, I think, in that process as well.
Excellent. Okay, great. That actually reminds me, I was listening to you talk, and I was thinking about one of the companies in your portfolio that when I interviewed them, I was thinking specifically about Airbnb. One of the things they talked about was in their really early days, they were having difficulty figuring out who their audience was and what their, sort of how to gain traction in different markets. And so they sort of, started, even though they were based in California and they were doing Y Combinator, they started flying to New York every weekend, and that's where they had most of their users at the time, and talking to people, what are your concerns, what are you doing, how can we make this better? And that was sort of, they were very much on the ground trying to understand from their very firsthand from their consumers and their users, what their experiences were, their concerns, to kind of grow the service into the, beast that it is today. And that itself, too, is a really interesting trend in terms of what they've been able to channel and what they've been able to sell, essentially, which is a really interesting experience, and get people to rent out extra space in their homes in exchange for, rent, but also this getting to meet other travelers and getting to meet other people and facilitating that kind of experience. Yeah. So it could be kind of interesting to talk about collaborative consumption. I mean, that's an idea that when you first hear it sounds completely bananas. I'm going to let a stranger sleep in my guest bedroom, but I use it all the time. I mean, you use it, and it's totally normal and fine, so that's something that's a really... It initially seemed like a strange kind of new behavior, but now it's second place. I mean, is that sort of...
I mean, I personally think collaborative consumption is a very real trend, and Airbnb is out in front of it. The first time I heard of the Airbnb concept, I must admit I thought it was nuts, just someone in your bedroom. I heard Brian presented at an investor conference a little over a year ago, and I'm sitting in the audience, and it was a lightning bolt, because he was describing eBay in the early days. For me, the analogies between the businesses are enormous. It started with a quaint little idea. eBay's case, selling Beanie Babies, Airbnb's case, stay in a room in my apartment. It economically empowers people dramatically. Both sites many people earning their livings on it, paying off their mortgages. The community took the quaint little idea and expanded it into new places. eBay didn't decide to sell cars. The eBay community decided to sell cars. And same with Airbnb. People are putting up houses and boats and parking spaces because the platform works for them. So, for me, that analogy is a really strong analogy, and it was one of the reasons, from the first time Brian explained it to me, I was completely in. And so big idea, they're making it bigger. And then, the quality of the experience and the quality of the website are extraordinary. Two of the three co-founders were classmates at Rhode Island School of Design. So they bring a real design mentality to the business. Mm-hmm. Lovely site. They're trying to bring that same design mentality through the entire Airbnb experience, from search through stay to post-stay, and trying to view it through a high design lens. And we think it has the capability to be an iconic e-commerce business. Now, talk about the quaint beginning. The site actually came out of an experience. Joe Gebbia had an apartment in San Francisco. Brian was living in L.A. They decided, hey, let's do something together. Brian got rid of his apartment, arrived, and didn't realize Joe actually expected him to contribute rent from day one, because he'd quit his job. So there was a design conference going on in town that Brian had come up to see, and all the local hotels were sold out. So they had the idea, what if we host some people in our house? Can we get them to pay? And they said, okay, we have one problem. We don't have any spare bedrooms, and we have no spare beds. And Joe said, oh, I've got three air mattresses. So I don't know why Joe had three air mattresses. You can ask Joe that. So they literally put on the design site, stay in our apartment, and they called it Airbnb. And so Three people stayed. They all had a great social experience in addition to the financial. But you know, but the guests loved it. It was a little cheaper, and they actually liked being in a house with a kitchen and you know, socializing with other people. The hosts had a great social experience and earned money. And they said there's an idea here, so they started a website. But that it literally came out of a real world experience, which I think is just so damn cute.
Were you at Andreessen Horowitz and they raised their round? Or
I was joining Andreessen Horowitz as they raised their round.
Okay. Because what I want to know is, like, you're an investor and someone comes in and they're like, we have this idea. To us today, it sounds totally commonplace, but how do they sell that idea to you? And what's your, how do you sort of separate this sort of part from in your brain that's like, yeah, that sounds completely nuts. You want to rent out the space in your garage. Yeah. Do you think people are going to pay you money to, like, sleep in your garage, which they will? But, you know, I mean, how do you sort of discern what's the process maybe if there are some things that you recall about what made it so compelling.
Right. Well, at that point, we were a growth investor there, so we were not the early money in. So a huge kudos to Greg McAdoo at Sequoia, who was the first large institutional money in. We were in a growth round. What we saw was an idea that has taking hold and growth metrics that look like a rocket ship.
Okay.
So then you're into, okay, what are the risks in the business? How big can it get? You know, a different set of questions.
Right.
But, all businesses go. There's Piero Midiar, who founded eBay, calls walking up and down Sand Hill trying to get anyone to give him a check, because the idea of sending money to strangers didn't resonate with a lot of venture capitalists. Now, the guy he found, Bob Cagle at Benchmark, happened to be a collector. He collects. He comes from Michigan, and he collects these high-quality decoy ducks by an artist named Oscar Peterson. The only reason I remember it is because of the pianist. And Bob typed in Oscar Peterson on the eBay, then auction website, and five of the real decoys were listed for sale. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I get it. But it took that unique experience. By the way, to get there, he had to navigate through... Pierre had three things on his website. He had AuctionWeb, the Ebola virus, and Area 51, or whatever area it is. So UFOs, deathly plague, and AuctionWeb. And so Bob wrote the check anyway, and it's one of the best checks ever written.
Ooh, excellent. Okay. Well, I wanted to take a break, too, and see if anyone had any questions for Jeff or anything that you guys wanted to sort of toss out, just to make sure that we kind of get to, you know, what's most interesting to people in the audience. There's one there. Or do you want to come to the mic, or might be easier?
Hey. I was just wondering what kind of companies are pitching you now and what kind of trends you're seeing in startups that are trying to get started.
Good question.
I mean, there are some areas that are trendy, but I mean, basically, you get to see everything, and you know, you stop getting surprised with how inventive and creative people can be. Another panel here today is the Litro camera that captures not pixels but light waves. I was actually in that first pitch, and you know, we weren't looking at photography. You know, we were not that interested in hardware devices. We're largely software IT, but you listen to Ren and you get a sense for what he's trying to do and you know, experience he's trying to build that 3 or 4 years ago could only be done in a room outfitted with massive numbers of cameras, all, you know, walls, lights everywhere. He now has a device the size of this cup that does all that in there. So we find that there's some trends we're chasing. I love marketplace businesses, and you're seeing marketplaces for everything you can imagine now. Mm-hmm. You know, mobile, there's the great mobile franchises are being built now because the mobile platform's exploding so big, so we're chasing those. We spent a lot of time on software as a service because we virtually don't have a single enterprise software installation in any of our portfolio companies. I mean, you know, God love SAP and Oracle if they don't change, because we don't have a one, and that's probably a pretty good precursor to what's coming for the future. So we chase some ideas, but we've seen satellites and you know, the photos, and the most fun part of the job is the creativity of the people walking in the door.
Are you seeing... Oh, go ahead.
How do we walk into your door? I mean, how do we...
I knew that someone wanted to know that, which is why I wanted to...
Get on a plane. I know. So it's... typically it's easiest if you get introduced. Yeah, so it's actually almost one of the tests to see, okay, can you get to us through one of our networks? So typically virtually every deal we do is a referred deal. You know, so they came in through someone. I mean, we have, Mark's not a bad guy to have on your door. So, a lot of people come see Mark. Ben is increasingly an internet superstar around his technology superstar around his blog. His blog is read more than a lot of mainstream newspapers are. But get that introduction is really important just to get above the clutter. I mean, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of people trying to get deals in front of us. I like to think we're pretty good. It also probably helps we have $2.7 billion to invest. So it's that's not there. But so the key is to differentiate yourself from the clutter. And an intro can do that. A metrics can do that. When you walk in and you see one of those, with this line up into the right, straight up into the right, it definitely catches your attention. So,
what's the ratio of the number of pitches that you guys receive to the number of meetings that you actually take?
Meetings. That's an interesting question. So I believe the numbers. We got 1,600 referred deals last year,
okay.
And we probably outside of seed deals, we probably wrote 25 checks.
Wow!
So it's a pretty ruthless process, everyone talks about this vaunted VC lifestyle. I miss this concept altogether. I'm working much longer hours now as an investor than I did as a CEO of a public company. So I'm probably not doing it exactly right. But there's an enormous amount of effort that's going into trying to find those 25 diamonds, as well as working with your existing portfolio companies. I mean, I've been there 8 months. My portfolio companies include Circle, Airbnb, Lookout Mobile Security, Pinterest, and Fab. I mean, fabulous companies growing like crazy. So it's, there are only so many hours in the day, which is why I'm here Sunday morning. Yeah.
Do you have any? Oh, you go. Yeah.
Just curious about the state of seed funding. And you mentioned you wrote checks for 25 companies, but you also did some seed investing. And I noticed a lot of VCs are now doing a lot more seed funding. And if you could just speak on that a little.
Yeah, no, it's we do seed largely for learning. We don't think it's very economic the way we do it. The seed valuations have grown pretty significantly. The terms upon which they're, the converts and things like that don't necessarily make it a great investment. What's really helpful is the learning. Hearing, you broaden your footprint, and part of how you discover trends that are interesting to you is listening what new companies are doing. So, we now participate in the YC automatic funding program with Yuri and Ron Conway at SV Angel. It takes all six GPs have to vote on every deal we fund except for a seed deal where, partners can chase things that are passionate to them. So, it's one of the more fun part of the job because you really are into the ideas now that don't yet have the metrics heading straight up. And, watching these guys make something of nothing. Typically when you do it, they're just a couple founders and they're there. That is one of the more gratifying parts of the job.
Hey, from as your portfolio companies scale, could you perhaps share some best practices and lessons learned with regards to talent capital and recruiting, and how do you scale that culture when you hit that ramp and maintaining, the support of your customers while growing the business?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I'll answer it from two sides. Mark and Ben, in founding, for the VC side and the company side, Mark and Ben, when founding Andreessen Horowitz, had a unique approach. The belief in the firm is one that founder-led companies are what's created the most of the value. Most of the most valuable companies in technology were founder-led. Apple with Steve Jobs, Larry and Sergey, Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison. I mean, that's there. And two, it's hard to be a founder. It's really hard to be a founder. So when they took their initial check from Benchmark Capital, they got 1/12 of Andy Ratcliffe, who's a very good guy and was a very good venture capitalist. He's now an entrepreneur, by the way. But they got 1/12 of him. them. They said, you know, the Andes network was helpful, but not helpful enough. So what Andreessen Horowitz has done is we have invested in a set of support services to help our companies scale. And two of the largest are engineering and design talent and executive talent. So we have seven people, I think, at the firm who do nothing but network among technology professionals, trying to, you know, get them in our database so that maybe they can match them with a company somewhere in the future, given their unique skill set. We have two people in exec talent trying to do the same. We have other services like market development that are introducing potential customers to our enterprise companies. We have marketing and PR. I think Margaret was here a couple days ago on a PR session about launching it. So one is human capital is critically important, and we've got a third of our firm doing it. On the company side, it is what makes or breaks companies. One of the things about the stage I've been investing in is for that early growth investment like Pinterest, like Airbnb, like Fab, where a company's just going to the moon, typically they don't have a management team in place yet. They may not even have their engineering in place yet. I mean, they are just holding on to the bottom of a rocket. And so it becomes that building the team becomes critical both to scale the business and for culture. And for me, the best practice in culture is probably the Airbnb guys. They're passionate about their employee experience, just like they're passionate about the design of the website. A couple little touches. They've recreated with absolute authenticity a number of the best, most rented rooms on Airbnb, and they become the conference room. So I meet in Berlin all the time, and it's literally the living room in Berlin that's there. So you know, there's no question what they do. They talk to they have group meetings of the employees. The employee base is scaling like crazy. They are always, you know, they have biweekly employee meetings. Every morning is the engineering meeting with standing at the huge whiteboard with every engineer participating. And you know, they over communicate, and it's clear what the culture is, and it attracts the people they want, and it blows away the people they don't. So it's a real screening criteria. So the effort they put into that is extraordinary, and the return for me is extraordinary because they have incredibly talented, incredibly motivated employees who are trying to change the world.
Excellent.
Hi, so I'm a huge Airbnb fan. I use it all the time.
Thank you.
And I remember they had a big scandal last summer when someone's apartment got trashed. And ironically, it seems like that actually was a factor that helped kind of turbocharge the site's growth as they announced that $50,000 guarantee and just a whole bunch of, you know, consumer protections around that. So I live in New York, and recently I think Airbnb has come under scrutiny about, you know, the legality of, you know, people subletting, doing micro sublets for their apartments. And, you know, and I guess my question is, What do you think are some of the key legal and regulatory challenges that Airbnb faces, and to what extent do you think that's going to really constrain the site's growth?
I mean, we think when we invested, we thought one of the biggest challenges would be regulatory because it's an inherently disruptive model. And inherently disruptive models, I had this exact same experience at eBay, face disruption. So on one hand, you have people with vested financial interests who don't want companies like Airbnb or eBay or others to thrive. In Airbnb's case, the hotel business maybe might not like that, or you know, the things along those lines. And then you have a loyal, passionate, maniacal community that's earning a boatload of money who loves it. So the two have to get to stasis, and it's going to happen in Airbnb, you know, geography at a time. We think, this is creating income. It is, you know, in a very major way for the community. So we think inherently that's good, and people will recognize, you know, that as a benefit over time. But, you know, you're in uncharted waters. I had the same experience at PayPal. No one had the thought of, okay, how do you regulate something where people are sending money, you know, through essentially email to each other. And so, you know, you'd go to the authorities and work with them through it. So a lot of the best companies have to navigate these waters, and we think Airbnb is going to be one of the good companies, and we have to navigate these waters. Our first senior exec hire was a general counsel with extensive experience in regulatory.
Hi, my name is John Perkins. First off, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm part of a social startup out of San Diego, kind of focused on social interest around movies. And, you know,
Movies?
Around movies, yes. And that passionate community.
Yep.
We have been in development for about 9 months. There's four founders, and we've all bootstrapped it to this point. It's, you know, we all have full-time jobs and really been focusing on product and on community. And so far, we've been able to generate a few thousand users from over 80 countries around the world. We've been featured on Mashable. And I say that only to paint the picture of where we are. And my struggle right now is, at what point do I not abandon product and community, but continue to do that, but start to roll in, okay, we're getting to the point now. Our private beta is launching in 8 days. So we haven't really actually launched anything yet.
Yeah.
And we're to the point now where I'm struggling with, okay, when do I start to go out and talk to people like you and these other, you know, VC companies, growth companies that can give us the capital to, you know, move away from our full-time jobs that we have on the side right now and start to do what we're really passionate about.
The part of that depends on your personal financial situation as well as, a calculus on your risk-reward trade-off. It's ideally if you can come in with some growth metrics that are intriguing, it makes an easier conversation with a higher valuation. But you know, that takes more work to get to that place. So they're the incubators that can give you the start, but the ones that really catch your attention, even if they're seed deals, are they launched and this happened. And you know, even if it's in one town in one corner, if there's an envisioned future that your early metrics can suggest, it's a tremendously easier conversation than.
How important is it weight-wise that those metrics are centered around users as opposed to monetization in the future?
As long as there is a monetization path, as long as you can describe it, monetization isn't that important to us early. It doesn't strike a chord. You can have these incredibly wonderfully monetizing teeny businesses, but they get a lot per user. In the case of Pinterest, we didn't even talk monetization model in our meetings with him, essentially, because we think directionally we know what's going to be, but the goal of the founding team was, we want to build if we build a huge user base, we'll be able to figure out monetization. So they're still maniacally focused on user
base. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hey, I'm Nick. First off, welcome to Austin. I'm glad we have some sunshine for you.
He brought it.
I'm a co-founder at a site called Moodfish, which is mood-based search for dining, movies, and bars. And we've been out to San Francisco raising money, and the feedback that we got was, move to the Bay and you'll get funding. Yet here we are in Austin at the world's largest tech conference talking venture capital.
Yeah.
My question is, do you see San Francisco continue to be the hub for consumer web funding, or do you see that shifting out to other cities now?
It's an interesting question. After the Fab investment, my blog post was about how e-commerce is surprisingly not in Silicon Valley and is everywhere else, particularly in New York. I do think there's some enormous advantages to the Valley. We have a stated Valley-centric focus. We have one office in the Silicon Valley. We will do deals outside of it, but in the Valley, you have lots of talented engineers with lots of capital, with lots of the infrastructure that knows how everything works. So it is a self-reinforcing cycle. That said, we're seeing fascinating companies being built everywhere, and we will we will travel to them if need be. Ben was going to Luxembourg for Skype. We have companies in Seattle, New York, Chicago. So we will do it. What we found is a lot of the companies and those outside of the Bay, sometimes when they're successful, run into challenges, particularly with attracting engineering talent. And so Groupon and Foursquare opened up engineering hubs in the Bay Area to supplement, they kind of ran out of engineers in Chicago. And so it's we think there'll be opportunities like that, but we'll fund a good idea from anywhere. I mean, you just have to. And increasingly, you're seeing great ideas happening everywhere. So it's I don't think it's a disadvantage at all. You just have to figure it out. The come to the Bay is, it's convenient for the venture capitalists. They don't have to get on the plane.
Right. Cool. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks again for coming out. My name's Vince. I heard about that Pinterest is doing great. We heard a lot about that earlier. I'm curious, and I mean, I'm just trying to put the question as most straightforward as possible, so don't take it the wrong way, but could they have done it without you, without a VC?
Pinterest, I mean, they did a lot of it with very low VC involvement. So they got an angel round early from some pretty high profile entrepreneurs, two of which introduced me to the company. Kevin Hartz of Eventbrite and Jeremy Stoppelman of Yelp. So they clearly could have, they did what they did without the help of a venture capitalist. I mean, we, I think frankly, we don't, for the creative idea on the business, that is almost always the entrepreneur. I mean, I think we like to think we can contribute to building the company, helping hire a management team, strategizing, rolling out, scaling. But, the core idea is almost always the entrepreneurs. And, Pinterest could have clearly done it without us. I mean, absolutely.
Thank you.
At some point, paying the bills is helpful, and we help on.
You're gonna step in there? Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Jeff, thanks for your input so far. My name is Stefan. We're starting a Quiz Fortune. It's a website in the UK, so it's not here, obviously. My question is, generally speaking, we are thinking global from day one. Is that a good practice? Do you go local first? Do you go global? If the latter, do I go and rent an apartment in New York for 2 months and try and network? Or do I go through someone like you and sacrifice equity in exchange for contacts, in a sense, and try and learn a new market?
Yeah, I mean, I think different businesses lend themselves to different development strategies with respect to global. A business like OpenTable or Fab is, OpenTable is going city by city, not even country by country. Extraordinarily expensive, operationally intensive to open a new market. And, there I would say, prove it out and then start expanding. Other businesses are naturally global. I mean, Skype was the wildest thing I ever saw, because what happened is its killer app is international calling. And so it went global, immediately because of the site utility. So I think part of it depends on, where are you on that spectrum. I think, if you don't go globally naturally, actively cultivating global, and it's not part of your model, actively cultivating global early can be a distraction, because you got to prove out the core concept. It's got to work somewhere. And then, because if you have a global footprint and it doesn't work, that doesn't help you much. So, perfecting it and then going global. So the Fab team now has planted a flag in Germany because it's working in the United States. And so they'll plant a few other flags, but again, that's operationally intensive as well.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, how's it going? My name is Ben Jackson. I'm a mobile developer. I worked at the Times till about 3 months ago with Jenna on a different floor. But so my question is, you mentioned, I think when you were talking about Pinterest, when you were talking to them, you didn't speak about monetization.
You did not speak about monetization during that meeting.
And I've noticed, I think in there's some rumblings of people being unhappy with free services, specifically because they feel like, you become the product, essentially, rather than the customer. My favorite example being Google. I know I'm not Google's client. I can't call. I can't pick up the phone and call anyone at Google if I have a problem.
Right.
But if I'm an advertiser, there's a number.
Yeah.
So my question is, do you think that there's a larger sort of trend towards this consciousness of the no free lunch aspect of the web? And if so, is that changing or going to change those conversations that you have with potential startups in the future?
Yeah, if anything, we're seeing more free rather than less free. I mean, it's just, and you're seeing it in places you never thought you'd see it. I mean, the enterprise world, you're seeing it, freemium models hit SaaS and things like that, which are just, I think that even though they know they're the product and there's a social consciousness about it, people prefer free. And so please go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the other example I was going to bring up is Delicious. When Delicious was acquired by Yahoo, there was a mass exodus, if I recall correctly, to other bookmarking services. And the one which gained the most traction was Pinboard,
if I
remember. And, and Pinboard's thing, their whole selling point, if I remember, when Delicious got sold to Yahoo, was we're charging you, like $12 or $10, and you're going to pay it once, and we're not going anywhere because we have your money. And now we're going to give you what you paid for up front. We're not going to sell you ads. We're not going to sell your information. We're not going to do any of a number of things that people become a little bit uncomfortable with when these companies start to monetize, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. Twitter being a prime example, I think, as well.
Yep. No, I understand the rationale, and from a consumer standpoint, I would probably agree with you. From a business standpoint, if Pinterest charged, it wouldn't be growing like it is. And so it's we're finding free. free just is so fundamentally disruptive to paid that you're trading off, growth. Well,
so I also, sorry, last, I'm going to stop talking to the microphone after this, but so my last point is just to address, like, I'm not necessarily only talking about money upfront and paid business models, but I am talking about businesses that start off with a very clear idea of how they're going to make money and are transparent about how they're going to make that money with their users, so that you don't sort of get that thing where you're like, oh, there's a free lunch, great, but wait, but I have to sign up for something.
Right.
You know, I have to give you my email now.
I like that when the business has that clear focus. Mm-hmm. I like that as a consumer. I personally don't use Chrome. I won't touch it because Google's knowing too much about me already. So if a business has that knowledge, they'll be there. I mean, the Pinterest directionally, we have an idea of where it's going to go, but that hasn't yet been shared with the users nor with the public, nor frankly, it's largely in Ben's head still. So it's I personally prefer it when a site does that.
But is it not always the best way to make money?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think whatever you do, you should be, having a community and being transparent with that community and truthful and high integrity with that community is incredibly important to building any business.
I should qualify, not make money, build a successful business.
Yeah.
All right, cool. That's it.
Okay, sure.
And we have about 5 minutes left, so we should probably just stick with the people who are queued up right now for questions. Yeah.
Thank you. Hi. I'm Ted Teal. I'm the CEO of Snap Retail, and we're an e-commerce and social commerce company helping hundreds of thousands of independent retailers plan their business, promote their business, sell, and stock. We raised $9.2 million in Series A, and now we're working on our Series B. We have a lot of momentum. I have a proposition for the two of you to comment on. Earlier today, I was at a session which was about whether or not there's a bubble. We're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which was named the second best large city in America for starting a technology company because of the
CMU.
Proximity of CMU, yeah. University of Pittsburgh, Penn State. But you made a comment earlier, Jeff, and it came up in the session this morning, where they talked about the bubble right now in terms of valuations is in the Bay Area. And you made a point, VCs don't like to get on airplanes. Right? So my proposition and I was hoping you might decide to cover this, Jenna, is that companies like ours are way undervalued. Huh. You can get a much better deal if you're a venture capitalist in Pittsburgh, if you've got the right company, the right opportunity, transformational, than you can in the Bay Area, because there's a lot of VCs that won't get on that airplane.
That's funny.
So they bid each other up.
Yeah.
So you pay way too much for those companies. So you might want to start a practice just coming to places like Pittsburgh that have enough infrastructure that we don't run into challenges.
I'm going to be in Pittsburgh next month.
Well, please come see us.
My high school junior is interested in CMU.
All right. Well, please come visit us.
Yeah.
Thanks
a lot.
Hi, my name is Iago. I'm with WIST, a geotag content app. And I have a question about international expansion. So we launched 3 months ago. We've gotten like 15,000 users. And while a third of them were in the U.S., and that was our initial area of focus, we've been growing a ton abroad.
Interesting.
And some of our most engaged users, for example, are in Mexico. And you're like, all right. So right now we're thinking about changing our strategy and saying, oh, maybe we should do outside in. Do we get a lot of international audience because they're not as app saturated as the U.S.? At the same time, though, we're kicking off our angel round of financing, and we're worried that we're going to be getting a ton of users that are less monetizable than U.S. users. But if we're seeing a ton of growth there, shouldn't we focus in that area? What are the thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting trade-off. Typically, a lot of international markets, the users monetize less robustly than in the United States or the main developing market. So you definitely got the potential trade-off there. But if you've got maniacal, passionate users in a market, I tend to chase the maniacal, passionate users and then, build something of value. And I mean, I think you chase the business where it is. I always love the paying through your cell phone business, through your phone number business. Boku's here and build a European business. Zong's there and build a U.S. business. So you go where the business is. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
You've said you're working harder than you ever have, and the firm, typically you'll have 10 portfolio companies per partner. You've got 5 now. Two-part question. First, what's the mix of your time today between your existing portfolio companies and looking at new deals? And I'm sure it's skewed towards finding, filling out the rest of your portfolio. But secondly, what expectation would you set to the venture-backed companies that you talk to and that are in the room? What should they expect from an active investor, from a time commitment and the kind of things you're going to help them with?
Yeah, I'm probably pretty close to half and half now between portfolio and new ventures. Largely, in a pleasant situation where a lot of my portfolio companies are experiencing hyper growth, and so there's a lot of recruiting and a lot of strategic decisions. So, I mean, that's the fun part of the job. From a expectations practice, and this is not just trying to pimp our firm. Typically, you get 1/12 of the time of the half the time the venture working on their portfolio. I mean, that's typically what you get. You get assistance recruiting. You get assistance. You get a Rolodex. You hopefully get board. You get board meetings, things like that. My portfolio companies are getting that. Plus the 28 people we have in our office who work to support the portfolio company. So there are 40 people. The last time I looked at formally, there were 40 people at Andreessen Horowitz. This is before our last fundraising. Six were investors, six were administrative people, and 28 worked with our portfolio company. So you have with our firm, you should have a fundamentally different expectation. And that's one of the reasons I'm there.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Greg. I'm from Inkdit, and this is my third bootstrap company. And I'm here promoting it, but my position on creating a company has always been that I want to earn profit by creating value for customers. And I've had a lot of bad experiences over time just in my interactions with some VCs where the focus is so much on the exit that I think that it can really skew the whole experience, so you end up creating this shiny object to sell rather than creating a company that's a real thing.
Right.
And so I was curious about your position on exits and how important is that to you?
Given the premise of our firm is that a dozen companies create all the value, we have a high bias towards entrepreneurs who want to go the distance. It's actually, in our offices, it's flipped. If the entrepreneur starts talking about an exit during an investment meeting, it's a major negative. Because we're swinging for home runs. We're going to whiff at times, but we're striving to build, to work with the entrepreneurs who are building the great companies. And so for us, it's a different, for us, that the talk of exit, we're not going to bring it up. And if they bring it up, it's a negative. And so it's a really different philosophy, from my experience, pursuing the venture.
That's a refreshing change from the .com bubble, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, sure. We've got why not?
So right now, what is the best path to making your site profitable? If it's not the exit, if you're not looking at the exit plan, yet you're developing sites where the content is free.
Yeah.
Advertising isn't working. So commerce, obviously, that works. Yeah. So what is there another alternative?
There's subscription. There's business paid. For a company like OpenTable, it's working phenomenally well. SaaS companies is working phenomenally well. So it's a very specific to your industry thing. The companies, the last wave of innovations, you get the Zynga and the Groupon and Facebook's, they all figured out models. They're all different models, and so it's interesting. I've been involved in businesses where the consumer, where the business paid, to the earlier question, the business pays for the leads. eBay, PayPal, OpenTable, they're all the same. Business pays and it's free to consumer. So, there are a bunch of, there are different models that can work all well. Anyway, I think we're...
Excellent. Yeah, we're a little bit over time now. But thanks, Jeff, so much for your time.
Thanks very much. Appreciate your
insight.
Taking the time. Thank you.